RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
If you remember, we spoke with Sue Gray, Anna McLaughlin, and Helen Tindall, who were in Geneva for the International Freedom Rally, and we got their reaction to the adoption of the IHRs. And a bit of time has elapsed since then. And Helen Tindall, NZD SOS researcher, along with all the others, is back in the country. And we thought it would be a good time to catch up after that chat back in the early part of this month. Helen, welcome back to NZ. Is it good to be home?
Thanks, Paul. Yes, it is good.
So how was that experience?
It was really amazing. We attended the Inspired Global Network conference on the 31st of May, the day before the rally. And Anna and I met all of the freedom leaders, like, you name them, really, they were there. Robert Malone, Matthias Desmet, Del Bigtree.
Wow. Yeah. What was that like?
It was fantastic. The room was really buzzing with really good critical thinkers, and the conference was well planned and organised with, you know, looking at ways to establish health systems outside of what the World Health Organization had planned for us. Mm-hmm. So sort of troubleshooting and critical thinking and analysing, throwing ideas around the room, lots of really good thinkers in the room. So it was really impressive. It was a great experience.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks for going, and thanks for making a bit of time for us when we chatted to you back then. Probably because you were there on the spot, just quickly remind listeners again exactly what was going on when you were in Geneva, and what was the reaction to it amongst the people that you were with?
So between the 27th of May and the 1st of June, I think it was, the World Health Assembly, the 77th World Health Assembly, was taking place in Geneva. And the two biggest activities at the World Health Assembly this year were the attempt to pass through the two international pieces of legislation, so the treaty, the so-called treaty, which didn't get up at all. It remains under negotiation, though, so it's not cancelled. And then the international health regulations, which are already in existence, the 2005 version, are in place at the moment, and they're trying to make big amendments to those health regulations, and they did pass them through, but it was a really rushed job in the end. It wasn't done very well. It was done behind closed doors, and they're supposed to present the final document within 4 months prior to the World Health Assembly so that the member states have time to review it and determine what their response will be. And the night of the 1st of June, I think it was, they were still working on it and presented it with hours to go at the Health Assembly. A very watered-down document. There didn't appear to be full consensus on it, despite it being very watered down. And there's word that there was a lot of coercion involved with delegates reporting that they were given one-way tickets, and they were told that their return tickets would be provided once they had agreed.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Gosh.
Yeah, so the World Council for Health presented, one of their lawyers went in and delivered a legal document which consists of three things. So a notice of urgent declaration of invalidity, which states that the World Health Organization are acting beyond their authority, and then a notice of urgent statement of dispute, which is talking about the Article 55, which states that they should be providing 4 months for people to review the document, and that they had not done that. So they're basically acting outside of their own regulations. And then a notice of urgent objection to the related United Nations documents. So the United Nations are also planning this pandemic preparedness activity. Mm. And when the lawyer went in to deliver this document, she reports that she met some delegates who told her that they were on a one-way ticket until they came to an agreement.
That's weird, isn't it?
Mm, yeah.
That's like sort of potentially imprisoning someone.
Yeah. Well, it's like gangster behaviour, really, isn't it?
Well, it does have a feel of a kind of a mafia shakedown, doesn't it?
Mm, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Go live in the airport like that Tom Hanks movie. You don't have your return ticket. A whole lot of health delegates who are living in the airport because they can't get home. Crikey. What impression did you get of I mean, we're just pipsqueaks, but I saw that you and Anna got up on the stage and had about 4 minutes up there. People were happy to hear from you. What do you think the impression of you guys representing us was?
I think it was positive. Anna was approached by KLA TV and did an interview with them. And she appears in the Highwire, the Highwire were there televising it. And she appears in their introductory video showing the highlights of the day of the rally. So I feel like it was a positive, we got positive feedback. We were up on that stage and it looked like we couldn't count the people, but it was thousands. So it was quite daunting, but the crowd was so positive that I didn't even feel nervous. I would normally be very breathless talking to a crowd that big. And it wasn't, it was just a buzz and fun and, yeah.
You mentioned, and you were good, there's no nervousness that I could pick up, you know, your experiences in other places. Maybe you should recall a couple of those just so, again, our listeners can, if they haven't seen the video or don't have time, they can understand the point you're trying to make and the kind of experience that you were drawing on.
Yeah, sure. So I've worked in a few places outside of New Zealand in Central Australia with Indigenous people and communities and remote locations. And I've been very close to people in those communities and kind of had a lot of time to reflect on what their experience is of colonisation and, you know, they have to work with a system that doesn't really match their culture. And, yeah, it's sort of, to me, that's what's happening now.
And that's happening to us now.
Yeah, absolutely. We are being colonised. There's written information about it. Pandata.org have done an excellent document, which I can't remember the name of, but it's something like the World Health Organization Recolonization in the 21st Century, something like that.
It's an interesting term, isn't it? Actually use that word. They use that word, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Using the word to describe what it is.
Absolutely. And if they pull this off, you know, the document, they didn't pull off a lot of what they wanted to pull off, but they have put in some new systems for us all to abide by relating to pandemics. And they're basically going to take resources away from the health system that we have in place that focuses or tries to focus on the diseases of relevance to our population and put all of those resources into a massive surveillance system looking for infectious diseases that are not really impacting us. And, you know, as I said in our previous talk, viruses are everywhere, and if you look for them, you're going to find them, and it doesn't mean that they're threatening us. So, yeah, it's a massive diversion of resources, and I've seen that happen in the third world where health systems basically are there basically to serve the staff, the health professionals make a lot of money and the populations suffer in the extreme. They have no rights. They pay for the system. It doesn't really serve their needs. They end up sick. It affects their economy, which affects the population health. It definitely seems that that's where we're headed.
Well, it's interesting. I'm just looking at some stats here from a report from the University of Leeds. They've done a piece on Pandemic Prevention, Preparedness and Response Accord and the cost of it. And they say that we analysed the data and evidentiary material cited within four key documents from the G20, Joint World Bank and WHO, the WHO Secretariat, as well as the primary and secondary sources cited in the policy documents that support their claims. And the University of Leeds says our analysis focused on the robustness for the cost estimations and whether the associated financial recommendations are justified as having an appropriate return on investment to support the current pandemic preparedness agenda. And they say there is a general lack of accurate PPPR cost estimations due to inconsistent definitions about what constitutes pandemic preparedness and inconsistent monitoring and reporting mechanisms. And they make other points, but it essentially boils down to this. There's a massive disproportionate investment in PPPR. Just to remind you again, that's pandemic prevention, preparedness, and response for COVID compared to tuberculosis and malaria. Massive disproportionate spend. And they say that this represents massive underinvestment when compared to PPPR estimates for official development assistance and relative disease burdens. Basically, about 35, 40 billion of official development assistance for the COVID effort and about, I don't know, all up about 7 billion for tuberculosis, malaria, and the WHO total budget. Incredible, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it's a business model. It's public money going into and you know, the system where, and people will be employed to make the system happen. And from my experience with my own colleagues in Australia that are going along with this, people will do it. You know, they want to pay their mortgage or whatever. And then on the other side of that circle of activity where you're surveilling and looking for viruses and locking people down and demanding that they take certain pharmaceutical products, et cetera, the arrow going out of that circle is corporate profit.
Yeah. It's hard not to get a bit twisted up towards those who take the money. Do you reckon? I mean, I kind of get a bit twisted up over that.
Yeah, me too. I struggle. I do struggle with that. Yeah. Because if enough people stopped and said no, then it wouldn't work. You know, they're relying on the compliance of the people. And the people that are complying that work in public health that have backgrounds like mine know. They know that it's wrong. There's no way that they think they're doing a public good.
What about New Zealanders involved in this? While you were in Geneva, Ashley Bloomfield was there. Dr. Olds, the Deputy Director General of Health, was there, and he was fawning over the whole thing, saying really nice things. They're selling us out, aren't they?
It seems that way. They're not being transparent with us. When we're not told who, there's people sitting in that room who represent New Zealand, and we're not told who they are. There was a list of attendees actually for the World Health Assembly. The World Health Assembly is a little bit different. We do get told who is representing us there.
Right. So there are more behind the scenes, are there? Is that what you say?
Yeah. There's at least six or seven New Zealanders there representing us. Ministry of Health representatives, mostly bureaucrats.
Did they have two-way tickets?
I'm pretty sure they would get their two-way ticket. Yeah. I think they're complying happily.
Yeah. We've had a couple of guests on in the time that you were there in Geneva, Helen. Meryl Nass, who you might have heard of, and also James Roguski. And it was interesting because both of them had a different impression of what came out of the World Health Assembly. Mm-hmm. Meryl Nass was kind of quite positive. She thought what we'd talked about before was a win, but James Roguski was not so happy. He said, and I'm paraphrasing, that basically the machinery of the OPEC-style pharma cartel, that the piece parts of that machinery haven't gone away. In fact, they might have even been strengthened, and people are kind of looking at the wrong thing. Is that, in assessing what happened there, do you share similar thinking? What's your view?
Well, I'm a bit of a Meryl Nass fan. I sort of steer towards her perspective more than James Roguski, I think. But definitely that cartel are well and truly established. They're not going away. And Meryl Nass has said that herself. We might have won a battle, but we haven't won the war. The war continues on.
When you were talking with others, notable people, about alternative systems, Did any form come out of that that you can tell us about, like how something like that could work? Because that's on many people's minds.
Nothing that we can talk about yet. It was really a brainstorming session with a lot of, you know, post-its and posters and ideas flowing, and they have to be coordinated. And we were asked not to share the information as yet. So, no, nothing that we can share as yet, but loads of ideas. And we came away feeling, I came away feeling semi-hopeful that something can, something positive can come out of this.
Semi.
We're up against, you just read out those figures, we're up against a massive amount of money and power. But people power, what the other problem, to my mind, the other problem is that not enough people are aware that this is happening, which is part of the propaganda. The censorship and propaganda is to keep people, you know, floating along reasonably unaware that there's really a problem so that they don't push back. So we really, we need enough people to be awake and aware that this is going on and to start pushing back and making demands of our elected politicians and
who don't seem to be too across it, I have to say. Have we had a bureaucratic takeover, Helen? Has there been a bureaucratic takeover of representative decision-making? You have to wonder if that's happened.
Yeah, that's probably what has happened. The cabinets have been penetrated.
Yeah, as Klaus said, right, quoted as saying, well, he's gone, they've changed the lead actor there.
Yeah, and it's hard when you watch New Zealand because in Australia they have, there's not many, but there's some really strong and articulate politicians that are speaking out and are speaking up for the people.
Yeah.
And you don't really see that in New Zealand. I mean, I don't watch mainstream news, but I can't think of any politician who I feel trust in that will represent us.
Well, Winston was saying some pretty good things around the election, and I get why he would have said that because he perceived an advantage there.
Sure.
But since then, it's crickets. Crickets.
Yeah.
And people have noticed that, and they're not too happy with that, I got to say.
Yeah, no, it's really strange. I don't know what motivates people to stay silent when something so important is going on.
So what are the takeaways from your experience, Helen?
I guess the biggest takeaway is that the people do have power because the World Health, International Health Regulations had a lot of their planned amendments were removed, and that appears to be because we pushed back hard enough, and that was an international pushback with some really clever people involved. There were lawyers and scientists and lots of, you know, well-informed people, whistleblowers from within the World Health Organization and within the United Nations. So people power can impact the result. I think that's my biggest take home. And just being amongst those people and knowing, you know, for a long time in lockdown, I felt like I was the only person in the country that understood something was wrong. And that's growing, that, you know, that feeling is gone. There's obviously a lot of people that know what's happening and are doing what they can. I think the power of the people is the loudest message that I want to get out, which I think that we need to say, to make that clear, because there must be people that know but are too afraid to speak out, or, you know, prefer to put their head in the sand and pretend it's not happening. But it's going to happen unless we push back effectively enough.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's good to catch up with you. Sounds like quite an experience to go through. A bit of history there that will turn out to be. But still, the jabs are being advertised on my Facebook feed now. I see one of the pharmacy chains. Come on in.
Yeah.
Still going on. There's no taking the foot off the gas.
No, and there's a lot of action taking place overseas, just over the channel in Australia. You know, they had the Senate inquiry into excess mortality. Two groups spoke really powerfully, the AMPS, the Australian Medical Professional Society, and COVERS, which is an NGO that represent the vaccine injured. And they spoke really powerfully about the evidence and you know, there's pushback happening against the vaccines over there, which we're not really seeing here yet.
So it was the road to Geneva. Helen Tindall, NZD SOS researcher, thanks for coming on, giving us a first-hand catch-up of what we were talking about when you were there almost a month ago. And thanks for making the effort. What can I say?
Thanks, Paul.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.